Welcome to Module 4, Understanding Your Distress. In this module, we aim to answer the question, what is distress? How does it show up for us individually, and what can we do about it? Distress is an extreme or intense presence of pain, anxiety, or sorrow. It can be used to describe a physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual experience, such as pain after a surgery or difficulty breathing with a cold. Intense grief or sadness that can make it difficult to complete daily activities, or anxiety that's causing you to lose sleep or exist in a state of hypervigilance and rumination. We all feel it. I mean, you have in this course. You're probably feeling it right now as I'm starting to talk about distress. Just knowing we're going to address it can kick up our anxiety around it. And when it shows itself, it triggers a whole cascade of symptoms. Your chest gets tight, your heart rate increases, breathing is shallow. You notice tension in your body. You might get hot. Maybe your mind starts to race or go blank. You feel almost like keyed up or hypervigilant, and you begin to feel your throat swell and a sensation of panic run through you. This is distress. It's a complete change in the mind and body to respond to whatever threat is in front of you, real or perceived. It's uncomfortable, and in many cases, a very normal and necessary part of the human experience. I would hope I'd feel distress when I just got in a bike accident or narrowly avoided getting hit by a car while driving. I absolutely want my body's response system to kick in when I'm walking in the dark and I hear a loud sound moving closer to me, or when I'm in a painful or uncomfortable conversation with someone that feels maybe tense and conflict-ridden. But see, the issue isn't that we feel it. The issue is the intensity, frequency, and effect it has on our lives. The experience is no longer appropriate or proportional to the overall human experience. So what can we do about it? Well, first, we need to answer the central question of this program. Why? Why do we feel distress? What role does it play? Distress is a signal to indicate to your body that you're experiencing stress and need attention. It's activated by what's called a stressor, which is a single or compounding triggering event. And that brings up an important side note and point of distinction I want to make sure we have for our work. So often we get lost in an attempt to control these stressors or these inputs by minimizing them, avoiding them, or preventing them in some way. This makes sense as stressors are the inputs that activate the body's stress and distress cycle. It seems proactive or upstream, and it works sometimes. There are absolutely some stressors that we can control. But radical acceptance, stressors are inevitable and infinite. Trying to address or prevent them is like going into a game of whack-a-mole with no mallet and a machine popping out moles double time. So being angry, sad, or resentful at the demands of your job or the perpetual workload that's increasing around it, the news, Aunt Julie or your neighbor Todd for their raging stance against your political ideology and unwavering ability to remind you of it, or the fear that's always lurking around the corner at what nastiness your toddler is bringing home from school, which, yes, is the very real one that I'm working on right now, does nothing but burn you out. My only choice around these stressors is to consider how I can change my response, and thus the reason that we're here today. So returning to our regularly scheduled program, we are talking about how distress is caused by these stressors. And you can see why distress can be helpful. It's a signal. But how did it get so intense? And why does it feel so consuming? Well, the issue lies in the fact that most of us have low emotional intelligence and processing skills, which makes our ability and comfort to name our emotions low, let alone move through them. We're also human givers, deeply conditioned in our shame to be fine at all costs so that we can keep up with the demands of hustle culture and be seen as worthy and valuable. We have an unhealthy relationship with control, exacerbated by that drive to be fine, which leads us to focus on trying to control or avoid stressors rather than learn to move through and prepare for them. And finally, we exist in a world and time where stressors are compounding at a rate higher than we can earnestly address them. Now, even in what I'm saying here, we can see that some of this is out of our control. We can't control what we've been taught and how we've been socialized to view and respond to our emotions. We can't control the patriarchal system in which we live, wherein power and dominance have created and continue to deepen ladder systems that lead many of us to see our value in what we do and how we give ourselves to others and the world. And we sure as can be have no control over 97.6% of the stressors that come our way. Whether it be the presence of a global pandemic, inflation, voting, and political choices of our loved ones, whether or not someone says thank you when you hold the door open, or if your boss actively works to respect and enforce those boundaries that you set in the office. But we can control the channels of input through which we receive stress, which is a fancy way of saying we can set boundaries with others and ourselves. We can control the work we put into learning and deepening our emotional intelligence. We can control whether or not we seek band-aid solutions or truly address and treat the wounds and pain endured. We can learn to differentiate good and bad distress and walk through the good so we can let go of those shame-driven stories we have so deeply clung to about needing to be and do it all for everyone else at all costs. And we can learn to radically accept what isn't in our control. So how do we do that? Well, the first step is already done. Just by learning about and considering the role of distress in our lives and beginning to differentiate between helpful and unhelpful distress, you're already starting to tease apart this tangled system. Now, second, we need to revisit that emotions list that I shared with you in phase 2A, module 5. What does your distress look like? What does it mean for you? Can you break down your distress into fragments? Are you anxious, afraid, sad, depressed? What is it? And using that emotions list, we can consider those different experiences and what that looks like for us when we use the word distress. So are there combinations of emotions that you most commonly experience? Are there different presentations that your distress has? In your worksheet for this module, you'll explore the idea of your distress and clarify what emotions make it up. From here, we'll rank your distress to create a scale of pain and suffering specific to you. This is because distress is subjective and relative to an individual's experience, environment, and biology. So to do this, we'll have you break down your distress on a scale from 0 to 10 and define the mental, emotional, and physical effects and how you respond, or i.e. how you act and engage in interpersonal relationships at each of these intervals. So next to each value or interval, we'll put down stressors that activate that level of stress or distress for you. So to do this, I'm going to ask you to consider different roles, relationships, pain points, and specifically your goals. What do we know will and has caused you stress in this program? What will cause you distress as you continue to move forward? And what effect will it have when it does if we don't alter or change course? This step of scaling and specifying how you experience distress is crucial, as what might be a 5 for me in terms of pain might only be a 1 for you. Or something that activates you at an 8 or a 9 may only be a 3 or a 4 for me. Getting clear on what has, is, and will cause you distress helps give you a greater sense of self-compassion and insight into what future TME investments we may need to consider or plan around. Now, one shame game I'll note here is that your shame, as we know, is all about comparison. So you're going to feel a pull to both have no distress and talk yourself out of anything being problematic, and yet need to prove that your pain is worthy. No comparison can be made between how any two people feel and respond to stressors. Again, context and biology are the key factors here, and no two people are the same. If something gives you anxiety at a 6 or a 7, but you feel like that's dumb or you should be fine, acknowledge shame is trying to be helpful, then politely ask it to take a seat. Fear and anxiety grow in the shadows, so being able to name them and hold space for them is vital in dismantling them. The other thing I'll say about this is that you don't have to prove your worth regarding your distress. Things are not fine until you get to a 10. Distress at a 2, 3, or 4 is still incredibly painful and deserves attention. Not giving your distress space at all points on the ladder is part of why we found ourselves here in the first place. Jordan deals with this a lot in the emergency department when he asks people how bad their pain is when they come into the emergency department for whatever their complaint is. And they'll notoriously say a 10. He'll even clarify, okay, so if 10 is getting part of your arm mauled off by a bear, how would you rank your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? And they might still say 9 or a 10. So while I do believe in some cases this is really how some people might be experiencing or perceiving their pain, I think a lot of that actually comes from shame, subconsciously telling people that their pain is only worthy of attention and going to be taken seriously if it's that high. So let's nip that in the bud. Pain is worthy of attention at every point, and addressing it as at a 3 versus waiting till it gets to an 8 is a way different and less taxing ballgame than the other way around. Now, once you've completed this part of the process, we'll begin the discovery phase by looking at what helps when we get to that level of distress, and subsequently, what doesn't. So for example, when I'm experiencing distress, which in my case is about 90% fear and anxiety and about 10% anger, at a 3 or a 4, cold water, a short walk, or talking it out with someone is really helpful. When I reach a level of 7 or above, those things are increasingly less effective. Instead, I often need to cry, yell, which I do healthily and effectively by singing music I really like out loud or going to, the car and just yelling a little bit there. Or I go down to the basement and I work out. Any workout with super bass heavy hip hop is usually going to help me, but specifically I like doing intense hip hop dance workouts. Often the crying ends up happening simultaneously with the dance, so it's kind of nice that I can combine those two things together. It's true. In fact, that's the way I've most effectively dealt with the intense waves of grief this past summer after my grandma died. So for some of these intervals, you may already know what does or doesn't help, and it's equally important to note things that don't work as well as things that do. But this is often a time when trial and error is also key. So using that self-care guide that you've been using throughout the course, you've tried various skills and tools to help reset or manage distress. Use your notes from that guide to help you with this. Maybe you found that progressive muscle relaxation actually works really well for you at a 6, but once you get to an 8 or a 9, it's no longer that effective. Maybe journaling works at a 3, 4, and 5, but loses its efficacy when you go above that. So be sure to try many items, including the ones you find yourself resistant to. In addition, I attached a short one-pager under this video called Addressing Burnout, which has some activities listed. Now, you'll notice a little bit of crossover with the self-care guide, but there's some new activities, and I break them down in a different way, too, which can be helpful. And finally, the last section is our radical acceptance and preemptive response planning section. So here we're going to look at the different stressors that trigger these different responses and explore some common yet often forgotten stressors while considering what is and isn't in our control, what we have to accept or let go of, and how we can set boundaries and change the way we show up in our lives to limit these stressors whenever possible. In some of the upcoming modules, we'll then be able to dive deeper into understanding how to set those preemptive boundaries. We'll also look at what outsourcing for support looks like and how to differentiate between preparing and developing resiliency versus trying to overplan or control and getting stuck in that hypervigilant response. So with that, you have everything you need for this module. I will say that this worksheet, which we'll refer to as our subjective units of distress response plan, is meant to be dynamic. So again, you'll be able to fill in a lot of information inside it, but as we know, we're always learning new factors about ourselves. So what works for us now might not work to address distress in the future. We might experience new stressors or see that the level of activation changes for old stressors as we move through time and do this work. So make sure you revisit this worksheet often, not just for the program, but as you think about your daily self-care and TME investment protection plan. I also think it can be super helpful to share this with other people in your life so they learn what distress looks like for you and how to support you. As you go through this, make sure to give yourself space and grace when you feel yourself getting activated. It can be a lot to hold space to think about your distress so granularly and without activating maladaptive coping mechanisms such as avoidance. So go slow, be patient, and when you're ready, I'll see you back here for Module 5.